And it's about 27 minutes now past the hour of 5 o'clock. Of course, you're at the Roadhouse. And we're joined in studio right now by Mike Crook. And Mike Crook is a prescribed fire specialist with the U.S. Forest Service right here in Cook County. Mike, welcome back to the Roadhouse.
Thanks a lot, Buck.
Been a little while since you were here. You mentioned that the last time you were here, we were still up in the at the high school in the teeny little studio.
You guys were interviewing me on my Portugal trip.
Oh, yeah. You get around, man.
A little bit.
And, of course,
For somebody that has U.S. before their name, you know, U.S. Forest Service.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of stuff elsewhere.
You'd think he'd stick around.
Hey, I stick around a lot.
I know you do. And, of course, the reason that we're in this time is because you did get another opportunity to do service overseas, and that was in Ethiopia.
That's correct. I went to Ethiopia at the end of February for about 2.5 weeks.
Wow. And, you know, when I think of Ethiopia, and I think a lot of folks out there, you know, only see the Save the Children stuff on TV like me, I don't think about trees. You know, so maybe you could describe a little bit about, you know, what was the land like there? What did it look like?
Right. Well, the northern and east or western edges of Ethiopia are actually fairly forested and mountainous. Mm-hmm. About 13% of their land base is forested. But what we were there for was more rangeland, what would have been traditional savanna, which we would call rangeland. That's where we were working in, doing rangeland management and using prescribed fire as a tool in managing that.
And you were working with a couple other agencies. I think it was the USA International Development Agency.
Yep, U.S. Agency for International Development.
And kind of a rangeland management.
Right. I worked through U.S. Forest Service has an international programs, and so a lot of what they do is in conjunction with U.S. Agency for International Development, and that's who paid for our group. There were five of us that went over there. That's who paid our way over there. And then once we were there, the project was coordinated and the logistics were done by Save the Children.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah. And you know what? We'll get into this, or maybe you can help us get to that point. But at first sight, you'd think, well, what does prescribed burns have to do with Save the Children? But there is a relationship there.
Yeah, there is. And you're right. It is kind of a strange connection there. But Save the Children has a project in southern Ethiopia called the Pastoralist Livelihood Initiative. And it's a big encompassing land management type of a project that involves livestock management, rangeland management, health and welfare, those kind of things. So we were one very small part of their entire encompassing program for just this Pastoralist Livelihoods Initiative. Mm-hmm. So
how did you get selected to be on the team, Mike?
Since I went to Portugal, I've been kind of on an email list for international programs with Forest Service, and I got this email about the trip to Ethiopia. And, you know, as I'm sure most of your listeners are thinking, you know, who would purposely want to go to Ethiopia, a developing country, to do this kind of work? And but, you know, I've always wanted to go to Africa, and this project itself sounded like a really neat thing to get involved in, and it's some, you know, prescribed fire is something I'm really good at. So
yeah, and here locally I'm sure there's multiple reasons for a prescribed fire, but normally we think of it as being because of our blowdown situation and the shape our forests are in, eliminating a lot of the fuel to prevent larger fires.
Yep.
That probably is not the same reason for prescribed fire in Ethiopia.
No. You know, fires on a landscape are natural, and, you know, because of us putting regular fires out so often, we've kind of gotten out of whack with the ecosystem. And so even anthropological fires caused by man traditionally are natural part of our ecosystem, and it's that way worldwide. There are a lot of places where fire was just a regular part of daily life, in southern Ethiopia, it was that way. Traditionally, the savannas burned very frequently and were normally caused, you know, set on purpose by mm-hmm. pastoralists.
And that would be to renew that area?
Exactly. Traditionally, it would have been, yeah, to renew the grasses and add more nutrients to the soil so that you would have this more productive grass for, traditionally, it would have been for wildlife and such, for hunting purposes, in more modern times for herding, you know, mostly cattle and camels, sometimes goats. But so, you know, that's what they had done. And over there, they had been doing it for literally hundreds of years.
And how come they stopped?
Well, there was a... In the 70s, there was a law came out because there was so much burning going on in forested areas to convert forested areas to agricultural lands that the government put a ban on open, you know, open burning. And it was misconstrued in the southern part of Ethiopia as a ban on total burning. And so they just stopped burning altogether, just dead stopped. And so what happened is over the last 30 plus years, they've, you know, brush encroachment and insect and poor grass production. And so the land was starting to kind of get overwhelmed without having this, you know, natural agent that would help eliminate a lot of these things.
Now, here we have, oh, I should mention that one of my favorite parts about fires here are blueberries. Obviously, that's not going to be the case in Ethiopia,
I don't believe. No, not at all. I'm with you on the blueberries.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah, that's my only. I think of fires, I think, yeah.
I've run into you in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Picking
blueberries,
right.
Yeah.
We have our favorite spots.
Lest the people get confused, you weren't, during the Ham Lake fire, you weren't.
I wasn't the guy, no. I was not the guy. And I was not cheering it on either.
No.
But it is about...
It's a natural byproduct.
Yes, yeah. Here it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, we better get back to Ethiopia. You know, here we have, and I think throughout the world, really, with with things changing rapidly, some of it we blame on, we can point to global warming, and some other things are just the way things happen, but do they have the same kind of problem with encroaching foreign species?
Yeah,
that come in?
Not so much the foreign species. Some of the interducted plants over there, the big ones are the eucalyptus trees that in the little less than 100 years ago, they deforested tons of a lot of their land base, and so they'd come in with eucalyptus, which is not native to southeastern Africa, but it was brought up from Australia and planted because it grows so fast, and because they use a lot of charcoal almost exclusively for cooking. That's their main source of fuel is wood for cooking, or dung, of course, for livestock.
And how did that eucalyptus tree change things for them? Do you know?
You know, it didn't. Eucalyptus grows incredibly fast, and so I guess and the benefits of it is that now you have this available source of wood that'll renew very quickly, 20 to 30 years, and it's at rotational age. And but the downside of it is that they're like sticking little straws right in the land. They just suck up water because they grow so fast. Mm-hmm. They suck up all the nutrients and all the water. And so, in some senses, that's a bad thing, especially in a place like Ethiopia. Where
water's
somewhat scarce.
A big deal.
It is a big deal. So
now you weren't there really to start fires or start prescribed fires as much as to teach them how to, or?
Oh, both. Yeah, both. It was practical. We went in and there were three prescribed fire specialists, me and two other folks from the U.S. Forest Service. And our goal was to train NGO agents that work over there, most of them with Save the Children, but there were a few other NGOs that we were working with as well, and do a in the classroom training as well as practical hands-on burning. And Save the Children had set aside about 100 acres of land for us to go and burn to train these people in with hands-on experience. You know, traditionally they'd used fire for so long, and then all of a sudden they had this 30-year, almost 40-year gap. And so that experience level kind of dropped off. And on top of that, they the population just exploded in the last 40 years. And so all of a sudden you have a lot more risks with traditional fire use over there. You know, traditional fire use would have been a lot like our Native American traditional fire use. They would have just let it burn with the wind, you know, much like our wildfires. And so our job was to go over there and show them how to burn and use it as a tool and be safe with it. And so, you know, we spent some time in the classroom with about 40 people, and then we went out and spent a few days out burning on the ground too. And the goal was to bring in these NGOs, these folks that worked with the NGOs, and then also the local villagers, pastoralists, and so that they were hands-on with them too. Because most of them had, especially the elders, had witnessed and been a part of traditional burning, and now we needed to show them how to do prescribed burning in a safe and controlled fashion.
So they didn't just start a fire and let it go.
Exactly, because they did. They wanted to. We got out there, and it was chaos.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no doubt about it. They wanted to just start lighting up, and they wanted to go with the wind and just let it race.
Even after you had the discussion inside.
We had a discussion, and then out in the field, when we initially started our fire, we had a briefing, and we did a discussion of how we wanted to do things and how we were going to be safe and all the aspects that go with burning safely, you know, how to communicate well and where to go if things get bad, what values were around that we wanted to avoid. You know, catching on fire, of course. And then, and then we started lighting, and a lot of, it took us a long time. That first few hours, they were not catching on at all. And it was a struggle. At times, I have to say, there was some physical restraint going on to keep them from going upwind and just lighting.
Oh, yeah.
Because traditionally, that's what they would have done.
Oh, I see. Yeah. That's why.
They couldn't understand what we were trying to convey with the way we were doing things. They wanted to go back to the traditional ways of lighting a fire. And it just won't work anymore with the way their landscape is. Mm-hmm. So,
and how do you limit the prescribed burn in a savanna?
Well, we had picked some natural boundaries. They had a couple of old trails out there, and then we'd also used livestock paths as you know, light off the livestock paths and let it burn out. Mm-hmm. So that you had a good black line, what we call a good depth of black line. And that's where we, you know, you burn the fuel sources out a little ways. And then obviously fire can't cross back over it once we light it out a little bit. And then in some places we actually had to put out the fire as we were going. So you would light a little tiny bit, maybe 10 or 15 feet, and let the fire kind of move a little bit. And then you would put out the one side. While the other side kept burning inward towards the area we wanted it to. And that was another complicated process. Now, you have to remember, we're in a foreign country. We don't speak the language. And most of our students, thankfully, did speak English. So that was good. Most of the villagers did not. One of the advantages is most children learn English as a second language over there. So if you were trying to communicate with an elder, you would just grab a kid.
Find a youngster, yeah.
Find a kid. And
sort of like me and computers.
Right. Yeah, I was just going to say.
Get a six-year-old. They know how to do it.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, and then they don't have the infrastructure. It's a developing country, so traveling and getting things. We use a tool called a drip torch, and it's a canister filled with a mixture of diesel and unleaded gas, and then it comes out of a spout, and you light the gas on the spout, and it drips little, flaming gas. Mm-hmm. And then the idea with that is that you'd have more retention for a fire on whatever surface it's going on your fuel. And so we were using a couple of those. Well, diesel fuel was easy to find, and I was in southern part of Ethiopia, not too far from Somalia and Kenya. And diesel fuel, everything runs off diesel fuel, so we could find that pretty easily. But regular gas, I spent about 3 hours, you know, with one of the guides, one of our drivers driving through town and looking for regular gas to mix with it. Hmm. And it finally found a guy that was selling some. And he was in this little shack in the middle of town with a big open 55-gallon barrel of gas, open. And he's smoking a cigarette. And we had this plastic jerry can. We take it in, and fumes are just pouring out of this thing, right? And it was scary to even stand in front of the open door, this big open 55-gallon drum of gas. And he's filling up our jerry can. Yeah, and he's filling up our jerry can with a little cup.
Oh, wow.
So 3 hours and we found this guy, and it was a chore.
A little bit of a challenge involved.
A lot of logistical challenges over there. A lot of emotional challenges as well, with working with people who are as poor as they were, it was, most of the people are very friendly, very courteous, but they are very, very poor. And
did you get much time to spend with local people? Did you get out in the community, or were you allowed to?
No, we weren't really. We were kind of kept under a tight control. I tried to walk from my hotel, my lodging, up to the classroom one morning, and they were not happy about that. Our drivers didn't want us. They were charged with our safety.
I see.
And we were foreigners in a. We stood out. It wasn't like we could blend in or anything. And people were very curious about us, and we would get mobbed on a regular basis walking around. So
people just interested, curious.
Yeah, curious. Mostly children. Yeah. But it could get overwhelming. At first they would come in, and want to chat with you, or want to, they would tease you. And then after a while they would start grabbing hold of you, and after a while they'd start reaching in your pockets, and
because they're a little desperate.
And that's what they're used to, foreign organizations coming over and helping them out, and so the expectation is that we are going to give them something. And so
how did you feel accepted by the local people?
We did. Especially with our classroom folks, we started feeling very accepted about halfway through the process of training over there. And when you're working with fire and you're working with the something that requires attention, constant attention and direction, you can't help but get close to the people you're working with. You almost need to, otherwise it just won't work.
Was it a large community?
The town we were in was fairly large. The community we were working with for the burn was a bit smaller, maybe 100 or so people altogether.
Did you kind of leave feeling that they get it?
You know what? The three of us that were the prescribed fire experts felt really nervous about whether this was going to be successful or not. We felt the classroom was successful, classroom training. We felt that the hands-on training was fairly successful, but we weren't sure if they would be able to do this on their own after we left. And within a week of getting home, I got an email that some of the students had gone out and worked in another community and had successfully pulled off another 150-acre burn. So that's, it's the first step.
Yeah. It has to become kind of part of their new culture.
Exactly. And I think that I feel confident with the way that they were understanding things towards the end of that week of training, that it will become part of their culture again. Mm-hmm. They won't be able to probably go back to the traditional way of burning, but I think that because they had that ingrained into them, through their culture already, taking this one step of doing it in a prescribed fashion isn't going to be too hard for them.
Now, is it still illegal for the local folks to go out and...
No, and in fact, it was a misinterpretation of the law. So it was never illegal, but it was a total misinterpretation. What was illegal was burning in forested areas to clear land for agricultural purposes. They didn't want to lose any more of their forested base. Mm-hmm. So...
I imagine you had to be a little nervous, the three of you, about a fire that gets out of control.
Yes.
when you're trying to teach them how not to do that.
Yeah, we actually did have the fire escape from us. And it was on that first day when there was so much confusion. And we'd gone out in the afternoon, and the temperatures were about 90 degrees. The humidities were down into like the 20s, you know, and so really hot, really dry, and the winds were picking up. And we were having a hard time explaining the process, and we were trying to go slow, but sometimes it just was starting to get out of hand. And at one point, the fire did make a run, and me and the two other prescribed fire experts from the Forest Service, we kind of just looked at each other, and we knew that we weren't going to be able to organize the folks we were with in a timely, you know, in a quick fashion to be able to knock this thing out. So we just got after it. The three of us just started pounding out dirt line around this thing, and we ended up catching it, but it took us probably about an hour. And we sort of had to ignore the rest of the classroom and the rest of the people while they sort of watched us. Yeah, well, we took care of this because, God forbid, something horrible happened. And boy, the locals, the pastoralists that lived in that community thought it was absolutely hilarious. They were laughing so hard because this was their traditional fire. Yeah. This is what they would have done. They would have gone up and just lit it and let it run. And,
look at the experts now. Right, what's going on here?
Right. So, I got one more story that explains a little bit about being in southern Ethiopia. It was while we were there, there was an attack by Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab's a terrorist group in Somalia, and we were within about 2 hours of the Somalia border. And Al-Shabaab started bombing this town of Dolo, which is just inside Ethiopia, which is about maybe a 4 or 5 hour drive from us. And so while we were there, the tanks started rolling through town. The Ethiopian army was, you know, going down on the attack, and we were coming back in from this field, and we saw all these tanks in town, and one of the guys I was with leans out the window and starts taking pictures, and the driver stops the truck, and our other guy sort of jumps in the back seat and almost, you know, just tackles him down to the floor, because apparently if you take a picture, you could end up in prison. Oh. They don't like the military, taking any pictures of the military over there for fear it might get out, you know, I don't know. But so, I mean, so there was some concern for our safety there for about a day or so while that was going on.
You could still be in jail.
I could be over in Ethiopia stuck in jail. Yeah, we had another incident where in the middle of the week, we woke up in the middle of the night to gunfire, just rapid gunfire, machine gun fire, and come out of my room, and I can see in the middle of town, you know, it's all glowing. The night sky is glowing, and gunfire is going off like crazy. And, you know, after a while, I went back in my room. I had no idea what was going on. I had no one to ask. You know, it was middle of the night, and there was really... the communication barrier was there that I couldn't just ask somebody what was going on. Should I be fearing for my life right now? So anyways, in the morning, we found out that the market had burned down in the middle of town, and the gunfire was to alert the residents of that area that there was, you know, an emergency, and that was how they
kinda, that's their fire alarm.
That's their fire alarm, using an AK-47 and just rapid fire into the air. And there was another emotional a component to that too, is about two-thirds of their market area burned down in one night, and that's
a big deal,
huge impact to that community.
Absolutely.
Well,
I saw on the website, the U.S. International Development website, that they're going to be doing some prescribed burn training in Hawaii, and Bob and I both signed up.
Yeah, good.
So we'll be there next. We're going to come down and talk to you first.
Well, I want you guys to invite me. Let them know when you get over there that you know somebody.
I don't know if there's room in the plane.
Yeah, I really don't like to share too much, but our culture kind of says let it run too. So
yeah, we're into just lighting them.
We're into blueberries.
Yeah, get some blueberries in Hawaii. Right.
Yeah, in Hawaii.
Well, we've been speaking with Mike Crook, and Mike is a prescribed burn specialist here with the U.S. Forest Service. Mike, pardon my voice. I'm kind of losing it here tonight, but it's sure been fun to talk to you about your experience in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
Have you got, I don't imagine you have anything on tap now, but you would probably respond to another invite somewhere.
I would definitely respond to another invite, yes. I think every few years it's kind of a nice thing to go on one of these things. Certainly helps at my experience level, but, you know, to be able to help out other folks and be able to use this tool across the world is pretty neat, pretty unique.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, Mike, for being on the Roadhouse.